This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Well, that didn't last long, did it? The United Auto Workers and General Motors came to terms early this morning. The industry's first nationwide strike in 30 years ended after just 2 days. But it's going to take way longer than that to figure out what exactly happened. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's great to have you with us on this Wednesday. Today is the 26th of September. The GM UAW strike is one of those stories where it's going to take a while for the dust to settle. Yes, we know some of the details, the key one being something called a Voluntary Employee Benefit Association, or VEBA, a trust fund that will cover employee and retiree health care benefits. GM gets to erase tens of billions of dollars of liability from its books on that score, but Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains that still might not be enough.
General Motors will put money, probably a combination of cash and stocks, into a trust fund. The VEBA will pay the health care benefits for active employees, retirees, and their families. The union will be responsible for the fund. It's a chance for GM to write more than $50 billion in liabilities off its books. And for the workers? Stephen Ferrugia developed similar funds at Buck Consultants.
What they receive is a reduction of the threat of bankruptcy and a wholesale termination of benefits in bankruptcy. What they have is assets, and that gives some greater benefit security to the participants.
The risk, of course, is that the fund runs out of money or that healthcare costs go up faster than people expect. The trust fund is supposed to be solvent for 80 years, presumably long enough for all current and retired workers to collect benefits for the rest of their lives. But Ferrugia points out that it's hard to project healthcare costs decades into the future. The union rank and file still have to ratify the contract. If it's approved, the GM UAW fund will be the biggest VEBA ever. Ferrugia says its size means GM's fund is less likely to fail. The large population makes it easier to predict usage and cost. And the amount of money in it means more room for elaborate investments. Just because GM and the UAW have agreed to a trust fund doesn't mean everything's hunky-dory. Brett Hoselton follows the auto industry for KeyBank Capital Markets.
This is not the entire answer to GM's problems. I mean, really what we're trying to do is we're trying to look at GM's labor costs, wages and benefits combined, and trying to bring those in line with their competitors, Toyota, Nissan, and Honda.
Right now, building a car costs GM around $25 more an hour than its foreign competition. This healthcare agreement could cut that gap to about $15. The two sides also agreed to a two-tiered wage system. New employees will be paid less than current ones, which will also help GM. But Hoselton says the real key for GM is to build cars that consumers want to buy. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
No less a figure than former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin weighed in on the subprime meltdown and the ensuing credit crunch today. At a conference in Washington, Rubin said, on balance, the upsides of things like mortgage-backed securities outweigh the downsides. Elsewhere in town, though, senators were having none of it. At a hearing this morning, they tore into the three major credit rating agencies over their roles in the crisis. And at the same time, the SEC said it's investigating conflicts of interest among Fitch, Moody's, and Standard & Poor's. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Senators said the rating agencies waited too long to downgrade mortgage-backed securities when their values began to plummet. Republican Senator Jim Bunning of Kentucky blamed the business model. The big three agencies are paid by the companies whose bonds they rate.
That is like a movie studio paying a critic to review a movie and then using a quote from his review in the commercials.
Sean Egan has been saying as much for years. He co-founded the rating agency Egan Jones, which charges investors for its ratings. Egan says that frees his analysts from pressure to inflate ratings. His firm downgraded Enron long before its competitors did.
Along with WorldCom, Global Crossing, Genuity, Delphi, you know, the list goes on.
In the hearing today, executives from Moody's and S&P defended their business model. They said analysts are paid for the quality of their research, not the revenue generated by their ratings. Michael Caniff with Moody's told the panel the issuer-funded model allows firms to share their ratings with all investors.
If an investor pay model is adopted, the fact that the rating is made publicly available to regulators, to governments, to other investors would not necessarily remain in place.
New rules to make the industry more transparent kicked in just a few months ago. The law requires agencies to disclose their methods and gives the SEC more oversight. Senators said today they'd like to give the new law a chance before imposing more regulation. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
In case you somehow didn't mark it on your calendar, we're smack in the middle of what's come to be called Climate Week. The United Nations Global Warming Summit started on Monday. Tomorrow, President Bush hosts a climate change meeting of his own. China, India, and Brazil are on the administration's list of invitees because making sure those rising economic powers do their part to curb greenhouse gases has become a major sticking point for the White House. But Sam Eaton reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, the solutions might be even stickier.
Critics say President Bush's climate summit is part of a well-orchestrated effort to delay any mandatory cuts in greenhouse gas emissions for the U.S. Its emphasis on voluntary reductions has lawmakers and environmental groups slamming the meetings before they even begin.
It's like a bake sale. You just contribute what you can, what you want.
David Doniger heads the Natural Resources Defense Council's Climate Center. He says it's not fair to expect developing nations to act until the White House supports concrete emissions reductions at home. But Stanford University law professor David Victor says even bake sales can do some good. He says Bush's summit is an attempt to use carrots instead of sticks as a way to coax the developing world into acting on global warming.
One of the things these meetings will do is try to find areas where these countries' interests, such as in controlling local air pollution in polluted China, will resonate with the larger global goal of controlling emissions of the gases that cause global warming.
Victor says cooperation between the U.S. and the developing world could be a boon for U.S. companies hoping to sell their green technologies to countries like China and India. But not all U.S. businesses would be cheering, especially if Congress passes mandatory emissions cuts and the developing world doesn't. That's where the stick comes in. The U.S. Senate hopes to introduce global warming legislation in the coming weeks that goes a step further than simply capping greenhouse gas emissions. It would also impose trade sanctions against countries that refuse to do the same. David Doniger with the NRDC says the goal is to level the economic playing field.
The often expressed fear in U.S. business circles is that we'll put a cap on our own emissions and companies in China or India will be able to make the same products without paying the carbon cost.
President Bush has said he won't support any legislation that mandates emissions cuts, though the measure has gained the much-needed stamp of approval from organized labor. But Stanford's David Victor says using trade sanctions to force action on global warming could backfire. He says the key will be to wave the stick around, but never actually use it. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
What was good for investors was good for General Motors today, and the other way around. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You've got to say this about American investors. They are truly eternal optimists. Take just the latest example of the current zeitgeist on Wall Street. That last month's sharp drop in durable goods orders that we learned about this morning is going to prompt Mr. Bernanke and the gang over at the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates again sometime soon. The cost of money is moving the opposite direction in Europe. The European Central Bank has bumped its rates 8 times since 2000, and there are no signs it'll change course when it meets next week. Commentator David Frum says that'd be bad for Europe and bad for us.
Central bankers are paid to worry about inflation. And there is no doubt that in Europe, they have plenty to worry about. Housing prices have zoomed across the eurozone since the year 2000. Household debt has swelled in countries like Britain, Denmark, and Spain to exceed 100% of GDP. But that's last year's news. In Europe, as in America, the housing boom is ending. Eurozone economies grew by 2.4% in 2006, a big improvement over previous years, but still insufficient for economies struggling with chronic underemployment. You'd think the European Central Bank would want to cut rates. Not so. Defending a strong euro currency apparently matters more than jobs, growth, and household balance sheets. The central bankers seem to hope that the euro will rival the dollar's prestige. To fulfill their ambitions, they are putting the world economy at risk. To prop up the ailing dollar, American central bankers may be pushed to increase interest rates just when worried American markets could most use a rate cut. That would hurt American, and therefore global, growth. A European rate cut now would relieve the pressure on the dollar, freeing the Fed to cut U.S. interest rates more. A rate cut in Europe would also stimulate economic growth at a time when the U.S. economy seems to have reached the end of a growth cycle. Since 1945, U.S. monetary authorities have accepted that they bear responsibility not only for the American economy, but for the world. But does the European Central Bank? One fears the answer is no. As the Eurozone has expanded geographically, it has shrunk mentally. As the bankers' powers have grown, their perspectives have narrowed. As the euro goes global, its managers have become more parochial. That's sad for the unemployed of Europe, but it may become a danger to the whole planet.
David Frum is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. You can send us your thoughts about what you hear on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has been sending out a little extra work to millions of Americans this month. The EEOC is the government agency that investigates claims of workplace discrimination. And to help do that, every year it sends out surveys on race and ethnicity. This time around, there's something new in there. After 40 years, the box that used to say simply Hispanic has been changed to Hispanic or Latino. We sent Marketplace's Dan Gratch out from behind the Americas desk at WLRN in Miami to find out what's in a name.
Latino is more accurate.
I am a Hispanic.
Latina.
I'm Hispanic.
I don't know. I prefer that word Latin.
Besides terminology, Hispanics and Latinos are split by race, country of origin, even fluency in Spanish. Diversity consultant Carmen Van Kerkhove says these divisions impact everything from marketing to hiring to workplace discrimination.
Certainly, people will begin to argue about who is Latino enough, who is Hispanic enough, who really counts, who doesn't count, because then you're dealing with the allocation of resources.
Pollster Sergio Bendixson asked 1,200 registered voters which term they preferred. Hispanic won out by a margin of 2-1. But those who preferred Latino said they found the term Hispanic offensive.
Many people of Mexican or Latin American descent do not have a very good image of the Spanish conquistadores. Therefore, they reject the term Hispanic.
Marketers watch this debate closely. Hispanic and Latino consumers are expected to spend $928 billion this year. And with continued immigration, that number is expected to top $1 trillion by 2010. But how can companies hope to reach this fast-growing population if they don't even know what to call them? Bendixson works with businesses to find ways to market to this prized group. And he's found Hispanics and Latinos have some things in common.
Two things keep coming up. They give personal relationships a lot more importance. They also will tell you that they're not all about work and making money. but that they are more willing to sacrifice financial success and career success for just the enjoyment of life.
The Hispanic-Latino distinction also impacts the workplace. Until this year, the EEOC survey only had a box for Hispanics. Many Latinos check the box Other. By broadening the category to Hispanic or Latino, the EEOC will get a clearer picture of what strides the overall group has made in the workplace. And it'll help determine whether they're being denied promotions or getting paid less. Carol Miaskoff's a lawyer at the EEOC. She says the agency's survey has a flaw. It asks employees to identify their own race or ethnicity, but some employers won't care what box a person checks.
They're going to look around and they're going to say, who looks Hispanic or Latino? And they're going to say, gee, I don't like those kind of people. I'm not going to give, you know, that guy a raise. I'm going to let that guy go, whatever.
The issue of identity really hit home for me when I sat down to fill out the EEOC survey. I can check only one box, but two seem to apply. So I asked Miaskoff for guidance. You have my picture in front of you, right?
I do.
Could you describe what I look like?
Well, you look like a Caucasian guy, brown hair, lightly complected.
Which box would you check for me?
I would say white. Yeah.
Well, I have something to reveal, which is that my father is from Spain.
Mm-hmm, right. So that means that you are Hispanic. But as I say that, I'm stopping myself short because I just told you that this new approach is self-identification, right? So if you were sitting down to do this form, you would have a decision to make.
Well, I may not look Hispanic, but I speak Spanish, I'm a citizen of Spain, and I identify with many Hispanic values. So I guess that settles it. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, what would it take to show same-sex parents on a kid's show?
The motivation for showing gays and lesbians and transgenders in the mainstream media is definitely motivated by economics.
Of course, it's money. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial jumped 99 points, 0.75% to close at 13,878. The NASDAQ climbed 15 points, about 0.5%, 26.99 there. The S&P 500 bumped up 8 points, about 0.5% to 15.25. The GM deal pushed its stock up 9.33%. Ford charged up 6.5%. Auto parts makers got pulled along in the wake, too. Lear, which makes car seats, jumped 5.75%. Vistion rose 3.5%. The tech sector hummed along. Red Hat rose 5.33% after it reported rosy profit earnings. And an analyst upgrade of Research in Motion sent its shares up 2.25%. The 10-year T-note fell. That means the yield rose. The number in this case is 4.63%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for August. A House subcommittee discusses possible ways climate change could impact national security. And events in London celebrate World Maritime Day. According to organizers, more than 90% of the world's trade is carried on board ships. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Author and social critic Naomi Klein has turned her attention to macroeconomic policy by way of shock therapy.
A collective trauma, a war, a coup, a natural disaster, a terrorist attack puts us all into a state of shock.
A bit dramatic, I'll grant you, but her point is that disasters of all kinds distract us and provide an opening for governments to make changes in economic policies, changes they otherwise wouldn't have been able to make.
Policies like privatization of water and electricity, the dismantling of labor protections, these are policies that are so unpopular that they can only be pushed through in the aftermath of some other shock.
As you might have gathered, the key word here is shock. In fact, Naomi Klein's new book is called The Shock Doctrine.
I mean, I think the best example is what happened to the outsourcing of so much of the military and of security in the aftermath of September 11th. I mean, that was a huge shock to this country. And the Bush administration very expertly took advantage of the extraordinary levels of trust and used that power to avoid debate about such core questions as whether or not private companies like Blackwater should be taking on roles traditionally performed by the military. So that's just one example. And another one is New Orleans. After the levees broke, I start the book quoting Milton Friedman, who's really the guru of totally unfettered free markets, saying that the flooding of New Orleans was a tragedy, but it was also an opportunity to radically remake the education system. And of course, New Orleans is now the country's leading laboratory for the charter school system. And this is another example of what I call the shock doctrine, using some sort of shock, some major crisis, to push through policies you wouldn't be able to otherwise.
But just because something's unpopular and just because something is installed in a moment of economic or great societal trauma, as in, say, New Orleans with Katrina, does that necessarily make it wrong? I mean, schools there were greatly troubled for decades before Katrina.
Absolutely, the school system in New Orleans was a disaster before the disaster even struck. But what I'm arguing is that people have a right to be part of the transformation and the reconstruction of their cities, and that lack of accountability, the fact that teachers and parents and students were excluded from the decision-making precisely because they were dispersed, because they were traumatized, because they were dealing with daily concerns, that actually you don't end up with a better system. What you end up with is a real concentration of power, and you end up with profiteering.
The other side of the coin, though, is that after a crisis, after a shock, whether it's societal or a terrorist attack or a natural disaster, people who do economic shock therapy, as you say, are doing something versus being paralyzed by inaction and doing nothing while they deliberate all the choices.
Well, there's certainly an incredible decisiveness in these moments. And that you're absolutely right. That is the mark of the shock therapist. But, you know, what I do in the book, I look at these key junctures where economic shock therapy was applied. Poland in 1989, Chile in 1973, Bolivia in 1985, Russia in 1993. So these are chapters in history that we've really forgotten. And when we hear the triumphant history of the rise of the totally liberated markets in something like Alan Greenspan's new book, we really don't hear about the role of crises and shocks. It's as if this was all demanded, and in fact, it was highly contested. So there are many things that are appealing about these policies, like tax cuts and so on. But when it comes to cutting social spending, when it comes to eliminating a public health care system or cutting job security, these are always highly controversial policies, and economists are well aware of it.
The latest book from Naomi Klein is called The Shock Doctrine. The subtitle is The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. Ms. Klein, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
In case you somehow missed the full-page newspaper ads and the promo spots that have been running the past couple of weeks, the fall television season is upon us. New series with new casts, returning hits as well. One group you won't be seeing more of, on network shows anyway, are gay and lesbian characters. The Gay and Lesbian Alliance said this week just 1.1% of all characters on the Big Five broadcast networks are gay. As low as that is, it's actually down from a year ago. And as for gay couples with children, they've never been able to find a home in TV land. But Alex Schmidt reports one entrepreneur is betting market economics can change that.
Dottie's Magic Pockets is a kids' TV program like any other. It's got a fun story, silly characters, and lots of songs. There's just one difference. The little boy on the show has two mommies.
My friends Celia and Sasha are coming by today with their new baby, Seth.
Tammy Stoner is CEO of Pink Pea, the company that created Dottie's Magic Pockets. Her own son was the inspiration for the show. Stoner raises him with the help of her ex-partner, Beth.
By about 2.5, we would say, okay, well, Mom and Oliver are going out or whatever. And he would actually replace one of our names with Dad. He had started asking for videos with two mommies. And after I did hours and hours of research on the internet, I realized that there literally was no programming available for him at that time.
There are roughly 2 million American households with same-sex parents. That number grows every year as gay families choose to raise children. You'd think that companies would be salivating at the thought of a clearly defined, growing market, but they're not.
It's a market that has hardly been touched.
Jerry McHugh is Senior Research Director for Community Marketing, a consulting group for gays and lesbians. He says gay men have been on marketers' radar for years, but lesbians haven't, and most gay parents are women.
The median income of those families who have children is about $80,000. They have some money to spend. It's a well-educated group of people. They're looking for products that speak to them, identifying their own unique characteristics.
If business hasn't paid much attention to same-sex-headed families, the media seems to have actively avoided them. Sure, there's plenty of gay-friendly programming out there, like Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Will and Grace. But in 2005, when PBS tried to air a show that included a family with two moms, activists forced PBS to pull the episode. Pink Pea's Tammy Stoner recognizes that gay parenting is still a sensitive issue. She's only selling DVDs of Dottie's Magic Pockets over the web, and she's not pitching to the networks, at least not yet.
As we become more successful on our own, there is going to be sort of a mainstream, you know, eyebrow raising where they're going to look over and see the success that Pink Pea, Dottie's Magic Pockets is having and want to embrace some of that themselves.
Media companies will be first in line to give Stoner a hug, if the money's good enough. Jackie Joyce is editor-in-chief of entertainment research firm Baseline Studio Systems.
The motivation for showing gays and lesbians and transgenders in the mainstream media is definitely motivated by economics. I don't know if you'd have to, you know, talk executives into the fact that there's a lot of money to be made there.
The trick for those execs is getting their hands on the money without offending mainstream audiences. In Dottie's Magic Pockets, Tammy Stoner wants to show the audience that a family parented by two people of the same sex is like any other. If she can convince viewers to accept gay parents, even just as the background to a story, she'll be helping out millions of families and boosting Pink Pea's bottom line. In Los Angeles, I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, we told you last week about some disappointing earnings figures from Bear Stearns. The firm reported a 61% decline in third quarter profits, a result of problems with a couple of hedge funds and subprime mortgages, of course. That bad news hasn't deterred investors, really big investors I'm talking about. The New York Times reports today Bear is in, quote, serious talks about selling off 20% of the company. Among those interested are said to be Bank of America and Warren Buffett. Bear shares jumped on the news up more than 3%. Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway rose as well, 0.09%. That's $100 to $116,000, $990 a share. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 99 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ up 15 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 added 8 points. That is 0.5% as well. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, taps run dry and tempers flare over water rights in South Africa.
We, poor as we are, have to subsidize the very rich people who are wasting water because they have jacuzzis, they bath, swimming pools.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.